Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules. Yes, Hercules. I am real and I am active in the world today. Yet, I cannot claim the honor of being the only modern manifestation of antiquity's archetypal adventure. Though he was enshrined in myth long ago, as an immortal, he still adventures in our collective psyches. New tales are forever being told of Heracles, as my ancestors knew him, and the old tales are continuously being retold. As in ancient times, Heracles may appear in different guises and answer to various names, but nonetheless, the greatest hero of the Greeks remains distinctly unique and instantly recognizable to all who take the time to know him. Know that it is my custom to seek out and learn from all the incarnations and iterations of my divine ancestor, operant archetype, tutelary deity, and highest self. At times, the lesson these cultural artifacts contain is crystal clear. At other times, their secrets require some thought or quiet contemplation. Yet there is always wisdom to be gleaned or a life lesson to be learned. So onwards, I am Hercules Invictus, and these are the legends of Hercules. Before we begin with tonight's show, I wanted to share with you my impressions of Hercules Amongst the North Americans by Mark Merrick. In 1986, a compilation of Hercules's amazing adventures in our nation was published by Penguin Books with a warning that it wasn't one of their classic titles. The chronicler, Mark Merrick, had previously sold these tales to such venerable ventures as High Times and the National Lampoon. Merrick's frenetically drawn comic strips, detailed maps, colorful paintings, and wise commentary lay bare the brave soul of Greece's greatest hero as he wends his way through Americana bizarro land. Merrick's Hercules is one part Euripides and two parts peplum. I'm a very big fan of both. Hercules battles a giant flying moose, harrows a bleak carnival underworld, topples heavy metal gods, and tackles beefy football players. He triumphs in his 348th and 349th labors and chastises modern religious leaders who doubt the gods. Hercules finds love, lust, lost treasures, heroic tests galore, and even a chance to atone for recent misdeeds in the pages of his tome. As if this wasn't enough, and I've only scratched the surface of the tales, there's even a 4-star guide to Greek restaurants authored by Hercules himself. How can anyone possibly top that? Hercules Amongst the North Americans is, alas, long out of print and quite difficult to find. Its bold originality and quirky humor, laden with social commentary through anachronism, make the quest to locate one a worthy and worthwhile endeavor. Happy hunting, onwards. And now for John Carl Pepe. Tonight, we are going to talk about Hercules' return to the Marvel Universe, rumors of Hercules showing up in the MCU, and we're going to start our series on Conan the Barbarian. Greetings, John. How are you?
Greetings. Very well. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. I was having a good time researching and finding Mark Merrick's book on my bookshelf, and I located an old review that I had done years ago. So I was really pleased to be revisiting that. It was a fun book.
That is very, sounds very, very interesting, very, very, very cool. What I kind of like is that it does really fit into, the realm of how the Marvel's Hercules existed, especially when was the book written again? It was
in the 80s.
So yeah, I mean, just sort of that existence that Hercules had in the Marvel comics, you know, just living like a demigod in the 20th century Marvel universe of the 70s and 80s, you know, being a Hercules in North America and having adventures with, you know, characters like Captain America, but also dealing with real world Americans of course, culminating in that great run, the Black Galaxy saga in Thor, where he, is Eric Masterson's roommate.
Yes.
So I think it's neat. It's kind of
that saga. One of these days, I'm currently reading my way through that. I'm like three quarters of the way finished with it. We did the first part
right.
of it, then we'll venture into the in between titles, and then the second part of that. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And again, you know, for a few weeks or a few months back, we talked about the end of the Evolutionary War, and again, that's where, you know, Hercules had hyper evolved, which then led him into the Black Galaxy saga. I think that was his next appearance after that. And you know, Hercules has been getting some exposure again, recent books. I think we had talked about the Maestro series that just finished up, and now the second one is on its second issue, I think, by now, where Hercules, a Hercules of the future, faces off against a Maestro in the future, and doesn't quite go too well for Hercules in that story, but it was always good to see a new version of that classic battle, you know, demigod versus monster. And
Hercules points out, though, the gods don't die like regular
people. Yeah, exactly. Right, exactly. I think as we had talked about with the last month with the Eternals, you know, that is what gods do. They die and then they come back.
And they come back.
They die. They come back. And so, I do remember when we were in our first one, you had sort of talked about what they had been doing with Hercules in recent Marvel comics, and I believe he has been a presence in the Guardians of the Galaxy comic currently.
And still is. It's up to issue number 11, which I just picked up at Joker's Child. And
Very
they have
nice.
One more in the Olympian saga. In both the Maestro sequel and in Guardians of the Galaxy, the Olympians are back. And in Guardians, they're kind of like the dark Olympians. And in the Maestro, they kind of go back to how they were during Pac and Van Lente's run, where they're like corporate types.
Right.
Yeah, so they returned them to those roots, and they had them operating that way. So it's very interesting. I'm not a big Hulk fan, and I'm not a big Guardians of the Galaxy fan, but I wanted to see what they, you know, were doing with Hercules and also the Gods of Olympus. And both stories seem to be winding down. I think Guardians has one or two more issues, and then Maestro has three.
Right.
So unless they bring him back for something else, I don't know when he'll come back next. Do you know? Do you have any idea?
I really don't, and it's interesting to see that is winding down. I know Marvel has another big initiative coming up called Heroes Reborn, where it's basically postulates a Marvel universe without the Avengers having existed, any of the Avengers type characters having existed. So I don't know where Hercules figures into that, if he is going to be a player in that event. It is interesting because, you know, there have been a lot of rumblings still about Hercules appearing in the MCU properties. And I think with all the wild speculation of WandaVision over the past 9 weeks, I think even his name was probably thrown around as a possible, this is the guy who's going to show up at the end, you know. So there, you know, a lot of potential for Hercules to show up. And so as far as where they're going to use him in the current Marvel Universe, again, up in the air, I think Eternals would be a great way to kind of weave him in with what I think Marvel is expecting to be the foundation of their Phase 4 going forward with the Eternals movie. In thinking about this, as far as where Hercules could fit in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, I realized there is this wonderful connection that I don't think has ever really been explored, and I think it would be a great opportunity for somebody out there, either in the comics or in the movies, to explore a connection between Hercules and Hydra. It's literally staring them in the face, you know, as far as what could be and what you could do with Hydra as an organization. And does it reach that far back? Is Hercules a player in an ongoing battle, an eternal battle against Hydra? And we just haven't really been privy to this information in the Marvel Universe up to this point, whether it be cinematic or comic.
There was a comic book miniseries that was after Onslaught, where they took some characters out of the Marvel Universe and they put them somewhere else for a while, and then they returned them later on. And Hercules,
the first Heroes Reborn. Yeah.
Yeah. So Onslaught, it was called, I think, part of it was Onslaught. And there was a mini series when Hercules came back from outer space. I'm not 100% positive, but I'm pretty sure that they had something like that with Hydra, and Ares was in that also, as well as some other Greek gods. Yeah, I'd have to dig that out. That's in a box in the closet somewhere.
I will have to, because literally it was just about an hour or so ago I had that thought and didn't have really a chance to delve into that. So I'm going to look into that and see that. That was a very interesting, interesting time for Marvel. When you think about what that because Onslaught led into the first Heroes Reborn event, where Marvel basically handed off their four Avengers books to the two biggest superstars of the time, Jim Lee and Rob Liefeld, and they shunted off basically the Fantastic Four and all the Avengers characters into a pocket universe. And they were left with a Marvel universe without any Avengers characters. And so apparently this current Heroes Reborn event is revisiting that concept. But, the interesting thing I felt as far as a change in a dynamic in a book that was always mythologically heavy was the Thor titles. And at that time, I remember they had Thor was back to being titled Journey into Mystery, and it was about the exiled Asgardians on Earth. I think the first stab at something like that sort of a concept in the modern Marvel Universe. So that Hercules miniseries I did not know about. So I'm, especially with the connection with Hydra. So I definitely want to check that out because again, they almost go hand in hand, Hercules and Hydra. And I'm surprised Marvel hasn't really fully exploited that, but that could be a great in for the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
I don't remember if it had anything to do with Hydra, but in one of the series is, I think Ultimates, in one of the Ultimate series, they had Hercules. They drew him very differently as one of Nick Fury's howling commandos. I don't remember if that dealt with Hydra, but that was a similar type of thing where they were fighting against various organizations.
Right. That's right. The Ultimate Hercules. Very, very different, though, from the traditional Marvel Hercules. And the Ultimates a very interesting experiment, and I think what it definitely led to as far as influencing the Marvel Cinematic Universe is amazing. And I think the first few years of that Ultimate Universe were fantastic. You really really couldn't be beat at the time, and it is sort of a shame that they couldn't sort of sustain that as a viable concept beyond I think the initial 10 years. Some really good stuff came out of that, especially that stunning Brian Hitch artwork in the Ultimates series. So as far as Hercules existing in the present, Marvel Comics, again, after Guardians, who really knows?
Right.
It'd be interesting to see what happens. And as far as, the rumors for him showing up in the cinematic universe, I'm down. I'm ready for it. Me too. I look at all I look at everything coming out in the next couple of years, I'm like, oh, that's a possibility. Oh, Doctor Strange 2, great possibility if you're dealing with a multiverse and other realms and, you know, beings with extraordinary powers. That would be great, you know. Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania, I believe, is the title of that one. And
yes.
That, again, you're exploring the quantum realm and another path to a multiverse. So, of course, another path to a potential to see Hercules. Do they do the thing that they did with Thor, where they make Hercules, an extraterrestrial being who is revered as a godlike figure, or do they go, you know, whole hog and make him, you know, the demigod of myth, you know, existing in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which I think, again, would be a great way to go. I think we had talked about in our first conversation how Love and Thunder would have been a great opportunity, the next Thor movie, to introduce a Hercules trying to woo a Mjolnir-wielding Thor, you know, Jane Foster, you know, and set up that dynamic, the rivalry between Thor Odinson and Hercules, is a classic one in the comics, and to see that play out on screen, and that might be something. That might be, you know, something that Taika Waititi has up his sleeve. Maybe that is an element that we might see in Thor: Love and Thunder that they're keeping under wraps, because they're also good at that sometimes too, is keeping the details under wraps and having
that's
some surprises right. show up. Yeah,
and
that would be the way to go.
Before the Olympians do exist in the MCU, because we saw a bust of Ares' head on that tower of the Game Master. So they're there somewhere, and all the places you pointed out are a good place to introduce the Eternals. They, as part of the backstory, they can have their interactions with Olympus, and in Love and Thunder, they can have Hercules showing up as a character in the Multiverse of Madness. So everything you listed, I hadn't thought about Ant-Man, but yeah, why not? That sounds
why
like
not?
A good...
You know, I mean, at this point, anything's on the table, right? And you know, it'd be kind of interesting too to, you know, now that I'm thinking about the Hydra concept, like how if I were given that pitch of like, oh, you know, pitch Hercules in the MCU, I'd be like, all right, he's James Bond because he fights against this spy organization called Hydra, but he's also the Hercules of myth. There it is. Go with that, you know, and maybe
Hydra,
you don't.
You can have Hydra agents disappearing and nobody knows what's happening to them. And somebody's smites and drag it out. And then a real bulky figure is seen somewhere like for 3 seconds and, you know,
yeah, but I mean, even just make him just this big, boisterous, you know, fun-loving personality like the Hercules of the comics, you know, just the guy you know, definitely you could find at the tavern singing songs and drinking beers before going out on an adventure. But then, you know, kind of put a James Bond element into it as well, that he's he's also trying to live this life as a secret agent and like a James Bond type spy, really. Just, and you could do it through the ages. It could be something that could be a period piece in the 60s or 70s and emulate those James Bond styles, you know, much in the vein of like how WandaVision emulated different decades of sitcoms, you know. People responded well to that, so lead into that into another direction and turn, you know, and be a unique take on Hercules, super spy who happens to be the demigod of myth, busting up the spy organization Hydra. It would also be like a real neat callback to, you know, I think of because we talk about Tarzan sometimes and the Mike Henry Tarzan movies where, you know, he's basically, you know, in the wake of James Bond, like they were like, oh yeah, Tarzan isn't always Johnny Weissmuller version. He actually is this smart guy who goes on secret agent type missions. Let's do that, you know. That's what I would do. That would be my thing.
Why don't you write that out and pitch it to Marvel? You never know.
Yeah,
that's right.
You know, if they're listening, sure. I mean, you know, get me that email address, right? That's the most sought after email address probably in all of Hollywood is Kevin Feige's email address.
most likely, you're correct with that. I'm looking forward to the take on Conan the Barbarian. Conan the Barbarian played a very important role in my life. I was, I believe, in my teens in high school when Conan came out. And I didn't buy every single issue, but I had a sizable number of issues until number 29. And then 29, I identified with so strongly that I became a Conan fan. And it was at that time that whatever books I hadn't read in Lancer used to put out the paperbacks of Conan's adventure.
Yep.
So I was familiar with Conan from that. So I'm still a Conan fan. Just speaking about his return to Marvel, I guess, where do you want to start? Because you prepared for this, so I don't want
to
trip you up.
Well, where do you start with Conan? You could start anywhere with Conan. In your introduction, when you talk about Hercules being the archetypical adventurer, that character, as created by Robert E. Howard in the early 1930s, is the archetypical adventurer. And if you look at, in a way how, Edgar Rice Burroughs, right, kind of looked to a lot, what Rudyard Kipling did with Jungle Book, and what Arthur Conan Doyle did, right, with Sherlock Holmes, and comes up with Tarzan, right? So then you have a guy like Robert E. Howard who, writing yarns for money, basically, and looked at how popular Tarzan had been, and was a big fan of historical fiction and a big fan of what H.P. Lovecraft was doing. And he kind of puts all those together and comes up with arguably one of the greatest fictional characters of all time, and certainly the grandfather of the sword and sorcery epic, as a viable genre that really exploded in the 60s when people were hungry for that kind of diversionary entertainment. And as much as we love talking about the myths, you can't discount the myth makers, and you got to consider how Robert E. Howard's story in and of itself, tragic, man who committed suicide at the age of 30, but left behind all this great work, very prolific and almost possessed writer.
Do you know the story of how he came up with Conan?
How one day Conan appeared behind him and told him that this is what you're going, this is the story you're going to write. And of course, what's interesting about a cat like Robert E. Howard is that he was a very complex man, and there have been several several books, one written again by as we've talked about, the controversial L. Sprague de Camp, Dark Valley Destiny, which I had read I sought that out in about fifth or sixth grade, and a very fascinating biography of a man, of which there are not too many biographies. There's another one,
I used to have them all, but I got rid of a lot of them. There's just so many things you can carry from place to place over decades. So Dark Matter Destiny was one, and something about Cross Plains was another one I had. And
Dark Valley Destiny was the one that I had read at a very young age. That was by L. Sprague de Camp. And there was also the one that I had never read. This it's called One Who Walks Alone.
I read that,
and that was turned into the movie The Whole Wide World, which I had never seen up until about a month ago when we started revisiting a lot of the minutia of Conan. And a very interesting movie. I think it got a lot of publicity at the time. Watching the trailer, the Nicholas Sparks, the Notebook type romance novels were very big that time. I think Bridges of Madison County was a big hit at the time. So they really play up the romance aspect. But it is a really moving but effective biography, biopic, as they call it, of Robert E. Howard. It's the only one you're going to get, too. Vincent D'Onofrio is fantastic, and really, I think, captures a lot of the complexity of the of this man and a lot of the passion of this man, especially when it comes to his writing and his creation. And that's, you know, that a lot of the, you know, the themes that sort of run through his work in relation to Conan is a bit of a reincarnation, as if he's looking into a past life. The first story that he wrote to mention Conan, called People in the Dark, is about a man in the 20th century who recalls a past life, and one of those lives was Conan the Reaver. Not quite the Conan that premiered in the Weird Tales story, but again, the sort of concept that Robert E. Howard, was peering into the past and pulling these stories from the past, or was compelled. These stories were calling to him from the past. Basically, another example of how much of a genius and a creative man that Robert E. Howard was, because alongside, you know, with the myth and the myth makers, there's the myths about the myth makers, right? I always say, to use George Lucas as an example, like I always say, the greatest trick George Lucas ever pulled was making people believe that he had a whole idea of what's going to happen all along, you know, when the guy was just making it up as he went along. And when you look at the actual first story that Robert E. Howard wrote, the first official Conan story, it was a repurposed rejected Cull story.
Cull story, yeah.
And, you know, he took By This Axe I Rule and remade it and it into Phoenix and the Sword. And the first Conan story, you know, again, the myth is great that Conan appeared to him and just started having him telling him these stories. And if you don't tell these, cut you down. You know, like, it's a great myth, and that's what Robert E. Howard was his biggest hype man, you know, and he perpetuated that as that was, when actually he was just, you know, a great line that they have D'Onofrio say in that movie, Whole Wide World, you know, I get paid by the words, so I write a lot of words. And sort of that's what he, you know, that was sort of this concept that he fostered and put out there. And I think it's amazing. What I also really find funny about this is, because, you know, I love weird connections to things, right?
Yeah.
And so what I really enjoy is Phoenix of the Sword is a repurposed Cull story, right? There was a Cull movie in the late 90s, right? Starring Kevin Sorbo. Kevin Sorbo at the time was very popular for playing a version of Hercules, right? On television.
Right.
Two things that really kept Conan in the modern zeitgeist was the Marvel comic, which again is celebrating its 50th year since the first issue of Conan the Barbarian for Marvel Comics, and of course the Universal motion picture Conan the Barbarian, which is celebrating its 40th anniversary this year, starring the Arnold Schwarzenegger, who hit a gold mine when he played Conan. I mean, that was his role. That was a role just waiting for him. And then he upgraded later on to the Terminator, where he, you know, he didn't have to wear the wig and have his shirt off all the time. You know, Arnold was always smart. Arnold was always looking ahead for that role that he could comfortably play and play a lot, you know? And I think for various factors, Conan eventually just did not turn out to be that role. It was you hear the stories about how he almost got beheaded, I think, in one scene, you know, with the axe head coming off as he's blocking it in the first movie. So it was a dangerous role for him to do. So I think that was always a factor into why we did not get more Conan movies. But Arnold, before he hit pay dirt with that Conan the Barbarian role, had some various odd, weird roles in Hollywood. One was as a in a parody of Westerns called The Villain. I believe Chuck Connors is the villain in black.
Yeah.
And Arnold is the sheriff in white with his 7-shot six shooter. And, you know, very, very Mel Brooksian attempt at, again, probably cashing in on the success of Blazing Saddles just a few years before that, you know. The other role he had was as Jane Mansfield's husband in a biopic on James Mansfield. He played Mickey Hargitay.
And Mickey Hargitay played Hercules in a movie.
And exactly. And
Arnold
Schwarzenegger's very first role was as Hercules in Hercules Goes to New York, where he was billed as Arnold Strong. So I think it's very interesting that you have, again, I find that funny connection, that that's how we can get from Arnold to Kevin Sorbo to Hercules, like in a very kind of cool roundabout way.
There's coincidences that you missed. The Cole movie was originally supposed to be the third Conan movie.
That's right.
And they change the plot is very Conan-esque, and Akivasha is a Conan, I guess, villain, you can call her, although she wasn't really a villain in the normal sense. So if you know, like, the kingship of Conan, you could very easily see how they just changed it to Cull, and they redefined Cull, who was actually very different in the books and in the comics. Arnold's third appearance, because he had contracted for three Conan movies, was supposed to play Conan in Red Sonja with Bridget Nielsen.
Yeah.
But then there were some rights issues, so they made up a new character for him. But at the time, in interviews,
telling
people that we call him Calidor, but it's actually Conan.
It
was Conan the Destroyer, and then it was supposed to be one with Conan as king, because they kept teasing that in the two movies.
To this day, he keeps teasing it.
He said they're going to make it like Game of Thrones, and he was teasing it for a while again.
Yep. I mean, who knows? Maybe someday we'll get that. I don't know. I think that is that is in the what if pile of films.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. So Cole originally was going to be Conan 3 with Conan as king. And very, again, what a great bookend with, you know, Conan's first appearance being a reworked Cole story to Cole's first movie appearance being a reworked Conan script. Another interesting, and again, you know, so again, you can't really talk about Conan without that movie by the great John Milius with the story by Oliver Stone, and you know, one of the great movies, especially of that period of the early 80s, where every movie felt real, right? You know, like I one of the things I love about that Conan movie, the first, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark, you feel like you're there in a lot of times,
right,
a lot of these situations. Whereas Conan the Destroyer unfortunately suffers, I feel, from a diminishing return, where it's a very sound stagey movie. You know, it doesn't have that verisimilitude that Richard Donner would always talk about when he made the first Superman movie. That Conan the Destroyer very much feels like a movie. Conan the Barbarian very much feels like you're in that moment, you know.
Yeah.
Something that Milius, I think, just really strove for as well. He really wanted to make it feel as if this movie did happen, you know, at some point, that it was almost a historical epic, much along the lines of how Robert E. Howard approached the material when he wrote it, because he, you know, he created this whole world, and he set it just far enough where it didn't interfere with history, but it could allude to certain regions and certain concepts, you know. But he really strive to be as detail-oriented about this world as possible. Yet, at the same time, with, you know, didn't mind telling stories, you know, never told these stories in chronological order, and always had attributed to him saying, you know, well, I just, you know, if you're sitting there and you're an adventurer recalling your history, your adventures, you're just going to rattle off whatever comes to mind. You're not going to sit there and be like, on day one, this happened, and go right through, you know? So I think his approach to storytelling is great. And while it was very important for somebody to come along and help preserve, you know, Conan at a time when he could have just been lost to history, to try and create a chronology. And a few people did. It is very controversial, but it kept it going. Like we were saying last month, you know, it just, it kept that spirit of that character alive. And again, those great Ace and Lancer paperback, you know, with those stunning Frank Frazetta covers that gave us this, perfectly defined image of Conan, yeah. You know, which gets us to 1971 and probably next to Robert E. Howard, the man who really is the most influential chronicler of Conan's adventures is Roy Thomas.
Yes.
Roy Thomas brings Conan to Marvel Comics in the 1970s and not only defines Conan for generations after, but the comics, a wave of the popular anti-hero. And it is in the wake of Conan in Marvel Comics in 1971 that we get characters like the Punisher and Wolverine and Ghost Rider, characters that walk that line, characters that have, you know, their own moral code, characters that walk alone in a lot of cases. And really, again, without Conan coming to the comics, I am convinced that we do not see those characters grow to the insane heights of popularity that they did, because he opens that door for that type of a character. And you know, the ultimate escape. You know, right? Gosh, if that guy really upset me at work today, boy, you know, I just want to sit down and read a story where somebody smashes somebody in the head with a sword, you know, like, and again, it's just that whole, you know, this is why tellers tell tales, and this is why, you know, Hercules as the archetypical adventurer, you know, begets all of these other characters who follow after him. You look at sort of the adventures that Conan has. They're very much in tune with what H.P. Lovecraft was doing. And they were corresponding. They were friends.
Yes,
they essentially kind of created a shared universe, because in a lot of early drafts of Howard's Conan stories, he's putting names in there like Cthulhu, you know, because that's what Lovecraft was doing, and they kind of wanted to show that respect for each other. And so it's kind of interesting, you know, and when you look at, again, Hercules fighting Hydra as a visual monster is very much like what Lovecraft was shooting for, you know, as far as
I wondered if you told her, because you like the connections between things, but I wondered if that's where we're heading, and you got this.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Eventually, I get there. I just I get paid by the word, so I use a lot of words. I get caught up in a lot of the things to get to those connections. And I always want to make sure you get it all in there. Case in point, you know, I'm talking again about the Conan movie and how it. Pulls from other things that Robert Howard did. Thulsa Doom isn't a typical Conan character. He is I believe, a Kull villain. He had the skull head. Yeah. Which is kind of cool though, because then that almost creates a through line between Kull to Conan, at least in the world of the movie, you know, because you do get a sense that Thulsa Doom is this, immortal character, you know. Mm-hmm. And again, a great performance of by James Earl Jones as the twisted father, the twisted father figure, which he was very good at in his career, including the recent Coming to America sequel.
he's a great actor, and his voice gave life to Darth Vader. And it was a bodybuilder who gave him presents.
David Prowse, yes. But again, I mean, James Earl Jones in Conan is just, I mean, perfect villain for that. You know, the whole aspect of his character that he used to, you know, look for steel and as the answer, and then found out, you know, that no, it was flesh. Flesh is stronger. What is steel but not the hand that wields it? You know, all these. I mean, that movie is just chock full of these great bon mots as far as, you know, what is best in life, and you know, Krom, you know, and when he's praying, you know, stand with me in battle today and give me victory. If not, to hell with you. I mean, it's just. I find it to be just one of those near perfect movies, and you can't discount the amazing score by Basil Poledouris in that movie.
Right,
there really is one of the most iconic film scores, and one of the things that I found during a lot of this research was the that somebody has actually taken the score to Conan the Barbarian and transcribed it to organ. And it's the most amazing thing that you find something. Oh, it's amazing. Yeah, the guy's name is Philip Kelson, and it is.
I'll check it out.
Yeah. I found it on one of them streaming music services from one of those big corporations. But I'll see if I can find a YouTube video of it and send it to you. But it's amazing.
There was a cartoon. Actually two cartoon series with Conan, and then it was a TV show that lasted not for very long. Did you get
that? Yes. I remember the cartoon series, and I kind of went back and watched the live action, a few of those. And you know, it's sort of this thing that they do, which is why it really makes, I think at the time, you know, they didn't know what to do with Conan, right? And the only thing they could think of was like, we want the character, we want the trademark, but we got to really surround him with a really eclectic supporting cast, right? Mm-hmm. And look, I got to say, at a time when diversity is a big issue, a big thing, you know, back in 1984, when you look at the main cast, or Conan's team in Conan the Destroyer, I mean, it's a very diverse crew, and it is, it would, you know, it's very progressive for its time, I feel. And at a time when it wasn't a big deal to do so. Right. But there was always this sort of idea that, okay, if we're going to be passing Conan off, as a licensed property and really build a franchise off, is that we need a team. Conan needs to be surrounded by a team. If he's going to carry a series, he needs a team, other characters to bounce off of it and interact with. Because it's easy to do Conan the loner in stories for a pulp fiction magazine in the 30s, or as a comic book, it's very easy to do the loner character in a comic book.
Right.
Well, you gotta, you know, keep ratings going, and when you have a character who a lead who is, you know, at least in the previous film interpretations, not as wordy, you know, as he would be, say, in the source material, and you not really at a time where or a position to adapt the source material as faithfully as it deserves, because you're doing a Saturday morning cartoon show, so you have to have these fun characters for him to interplay off of, and you applaud the effort, but it's sort of, again, what we had talked about early on as far as this is where you get into the realm of a very sanitized, licensed version of a character. You know, this is you know, Conan of Conan the Adventurer, both the cartoons and the live action series, are very much the me Tarzan you Jane version of Conan. You know, it is a very watered down interpretation of that character. Doesn't mean that they don't serve their place, and there are people who actually love the animated series. The live action show gets a little less love, I think, in some of the Conan circles. And I think a lot of it is because it does make an attempt to adapt elements of the Robert E. Howard stuff, but really cheapens out, I think, or walks up to that line, and then it's like, I'm not going to go all the way over that line, you know. Case in point, I feel like the first episode, the first two episodes, does somewhat of a loose adaptation of the Tower of the Elephant. And they don't go so far as to make them space aliens. They are the elephant and the giant spider are couples who were turned into those animals by the sorcerer, which is, you know, again, still get to the sorcerer getting his comeuppance with the orb at the end, and still plays out as intended, which is fine, but it loses that. Again, that real mystical element that I think really needs to be there in Conan, the sort of otherworldly element. When Milius talks about having James Earl Jones top him on, turn to a snake in that scene in the first Conan movie, he goes, "We don't need to explain it. It just exists." Because it does, and it's supernatural enough that it doesn't really need to be explored, you know? And I think that that's what some of the, you know, something that was lost sight of in the remake with Jason Momoa, who made a great Conan. Hands down, I thought was a fantastic Conan. I appreciate their efforts to, again, try to make it fit within the world of the existing stories, because there is even a Tower of the Elephant reference in that, you know. Setting that movie into a specific point in a one of the chronologies that exist for Conan. I feel that that's a movie that leans too far into the mystical and the supernatural. And I think that what you need is that right balance. And I think they achieve it with that first movie, and they have never quite had a chance to get there since, you know. And at this point, you know, who's going to try again? What's the next stab going to be? You know, it is a daunting task. It is taking a character with not a lot of film appearances, but a rich history and a rabid following, you know. And it's sort of like one of those things where whatever you try to do with that property, it will always be held up against that one specific movie as far as the mass media and the popular culture.
Right.
And as far as what you do in comics, it will always be held up to what Roy Thomas and Barry Windsor Smith did, you know, in those early years of Conan. And anybody who writes a Conan novel, there are great authors who went on to amazing fame, like Robert Jordan, you know.
I have most of those.
Harry Turtledove. Yeah. Everything they write, though, that's going to be held up against what Robert E. Howard did.
Right.
And anybody who does anything with Conan, they're going to hold it up against what Robert E. Howard did. And, you know, you just you look at that story, you look about that man and what he was able to achieve, and didn't even know it at the time, had no idea, and didn't get to see it, and, you know, is just one of, I think, the greatest tragedies, I think, of modern movies. Especially, you know, you put it up there with creators getting screwed out of royalties or getting creation stolen from them. I mean, look, Jerry Siegel, Joe Shuster, what happened with them concerning their life for Superman? I mean, it's, you know, it was awful. But they got to see the joy that their creation brought, and they got some restitution, you know.
Right.
The one thing that Robert E. Howard needed to see in order to, you know, I think to have not committed suicide at the age 30
right.
was the success of this character and the joy that it had brought to so many people, you know, the you know, to give courage to outsiders, you know, to give an escape for people who have, you know, just need an escape, who just the real world is getting too much for them, you know. And he probably saved countless lives just with this creation alone.
Yeah.
And it is a shame that he had to suffer for it. But that takes Robert E. Howard to this next level as a mythmaker, because now he himself is mythological. Because we only know about him from letters that he wrote, letters that people wrote to him.
Mm-hmm.
There's no, you know, there's very little film footage exists of this man. You know, it's a very the famous picture, right? You know, but you know, we only know really recollections of him, and he is become myth, you know, just like his character, who, you know, was created in the same spirit that the old Greek storytellers created Hercules, you know?
Right.
And that's why these characters are very much cut from the same loincloth, if you will. They occupy that need
mm-hmm.
for the hero myth. And it's very important, you know?
What attracted me to him in the first place when I was a kid was that he was a non-Greek Hercules. That's basically how I saw him. Conan also had that he wasn't the son of a god, and he didn't have any superpowers. And the whole thing with Conan is that an individual can take on all that the world has to throw at them, and although not always triumph more often than not. And that's, as you said, you know, he saved very many people by creating Conan. And Conan has served that purpose in many lives of people that I've talked to. And you're right.
Yeah.
It's a shame that was something he would never realize, something he would never see during his incarnation on this plane or on this planet.
Yeah. But he knows, you know, I'm sure he looking down, you know, or a part of all of it, you know, and is able to feel, you know, some aspect of him, you know, what he left behind.
People have put him in stories, and I just looked at the clock. We have around 7 minutes. So the rest of it's yours until like 3 minutes. You have 4 minutes. And then the last 3 minutes, I'd like you to share how people can contact you and the Joker's Child.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, what I was going to say was, you know, one of the great descriptions that Robert E. Howard gave to Conan was that he was a man of great melancholies and a man of great mirth. And I think that is such a great description. I feel everybody can react to that or respond to that or connect to that, you know? And again, it's just, you are grateful that these characters do exist, and that we could spend even more hours talking about Conan, and I'm sure we will.
We will lump him
in among the big tapestry of all the great myths and how we respond to them and how we react to them and why they are important parts of our lives and why myths exist, and that is why we do this, and that is this monthly conversation is a highlight of my month, because I always look forward to where we're going
to
go and what tangents we're going to get into and what we get to talk about and what we don't get to talk about, you know. Trying to look and see if there's anything else. You know, I guess at this point, these myths play out in the books that we read, and the stories that we tell each other. And then again, we also get the opportunity to read about them in comic books that, you know, come out every week, which is going to be my segue now into, you know, talking about how I can always be found at the Joker's Child in Fairlawn, New Jersey, 12-23 River Road. New comic books, DC comic books on Tuesday, Marvel and everybody else on Wednesday. There's a new Eternals coming out this Wednesday, so I know you're looking forward to that. And, you know, I just, like I said, I can also be reached out on Facebook. You're very good at posting those links when you hype up the show. I, you know, again, always grateful to you. I look forward to what we're going to tackle next.
Same here.
Anybody, feel free to reach out to me. I accept compliments and complaints in equal measure. Because I know I don't always get it right, but that's why we're here, is to bounce ideas off of each other. So I guess at this point, as we wrap up, again, I want to thank you, Hercules, for all that you do, especially with what you do with your community and the positivity that you put out there with your daily messages from Mount Olympus. You were an inspiration, and again, like I said, a highlight of my month is talking with you about this nerd stuff. And to you and everybody listening, you know, keep reading, keep telling stories, keep sharing things that you love, and may all your days be days of high adventure.
There you go. I can think of no better way to end the episode. I look forward to our conversations too, and it's one of my high points in my month also. And you're very knowledgeable and very articulate, and you have a great sense of humor. So you're lots of fun to talk to, and I wish we had more than an hour. But we will continue with Conan. We haven't touched on a lot still with the Barbarian, his move from Marble to Black Horse. Then there was another comic book company for a while, very briefly, that was handling the Robert E. Howard properties. I had him on my TV show when I had a TV show like decades ago. There was, I don't know if he had Conan, but he had all the other all the other Robert E. Howard properties. And he was giving out really great comics. And he also had Red Sonja. This is before they made Red Sonja into a separate property. So let me see if I can dig up information on that. Have you ever checked out Zenoscope, their releases?
They do a lot of the Grimm's Fairy Tale stuff too, right?
They had a version of Hercules in there. I think it was called Godstorm. I'm not 100% positive about that. It's been years, but I reviewed them once upon a time, and I interviewed Pat Chan, who put together the Hercules character and wove him in, and he had a mini series and he appeared in other issues. And so I interviewed Pat Chan, and Pat Chan went on to do a lot of things for the MCU. After that, he was writing the novelizations for like the early Marvel Universe movies. Then I lost track of him. So it will be good to revisit. How about next time we continue with Conan, and we, since we've exhausted Marvel and DC for now until we get into the Black Galaxy saga, how about we do that next time?
Yeah, sounds good. And you never know, man, the way the Marvel machine works, we might have some Hercules news by the time we talk again in 4 months, or at least some more rumors to share, because those are always fun too.
Thanks again, and thanks to everybody who's joined us tonight, be it live or later on demand. Until next time, this is John and I wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. In the few seconds we have left, we'll close with If You Can Dream.
If you can dream, if you can fly, then your heart can but only if you can dream. If love is true and love is real, pain and sorrow soon will heal, but only